Hey, everyone, and welcome back to the Waxcast podcast. I am your host, Gavin Wax. This is episode 17, and I'm joined by a good friend of mine, Ron Coleman, who is a partner at the New York, New Jersey office of Dillon Law, a good friend of mine, an advisory board member on the New York Young Republican Club, and a survivor of the disastrous Jersey City 108th annual gala of that club, where many people were reported to supposedly fall ill and victim to the China virus, ended up surviving. So we wanted to bring him on to discuss this experience as a police car drives by my apartment. Ron, how are you feeling? Any symptoms?
So how many did we lose as a result of that event? I actually kind of lost track.
I think we've lost all of zero. No one was reported sick. No one caught it. So it was probably a healthier event than most BLM or Antifa rallies. I also have to say, I don't know what browser you had opened up, but you must have had 100 tabs open because the second you closed it, your internet came back to life. So I have to actually give you credit for whatever you had opened on your computer because it did give juice back to your internet. But we are glad that you are a survivor. I see that you have your award right over your shoulder there. I have the physical awards coming to you shortly, so I hope you're okay.
But
What's going on in Jersey? What's going on in Jersey? You have this governor there who felt the need to comment on our gala. He misappropriated Yiddish culture to call Matt Gaetz for putz, and he was very upset that we had an event. What do you make of Governor Murphy?
Well, I will tell you the truth. New Jersey has been relatively sane over the last couple of months. What happened in Jersey City, though, was the validity of advice that I had been giving organizations that were calling me and asking for legal representation during the summer in particular. And what I was telling them was, listen, and this was mostly in New York, actually, and I was telling them, your main job is not to embarrass the governor. If you do, and that's true in every one of these blue states, if you do something that's going to come up to the level of getting press attention and making the governor or the mayor look bad, then you're going to get closed down. And if you act in a way that doesn't make one of these guys or women look like their power is being questioned by the people in any way who live in their state, then chances are you'll be able to do what you want to do. And that was what the lashing out was by de Blasio and by Cuomo. Cuomo was just shut down once again by the Second Circuit earlier today, trying to basically ignore the Supreme Court's ruling in his case, which is unbelievable.
They don't want to be embarrassed. They want their little fiefdoms. They want to appear that they have all this power. But if you kind of make them look bad, if you embarrass them, if they have to be called out on MSNBC, like Mr. Murphy was, Governor Murphy, then, you know, that's when all hell will break loose. That's the Coleman angle here.
Right. And that's what happened in Jersey City, is that we got a little bit of social media attention. The press picked up on it. That in turn embarrassed the mayor. The mayor probably called the governor. I'd be surprised if that didn't happen. The governor, got out of bed, sent a tweet, went back to bed. And as you know, no cherry tops, as Bruce Springsteen would call them. Nonetheless, rounded any of us up. I didn't have to make use of my Sopranos-like armory that everyone here in Northern New Jersey keeps at the ready in the event, the heat shows up. So,
well, the funny thing is, as you brought up a good point, is that Jersey has been maybe more moderate than, say, New York. And they do it purposely because they want to get the money and the businesses and all the funds to flow over the river into Jersey so they could take advantage of it. So they purposely make their laws and their rules a little laxer than New York. You can fly into out of Newark, no problem. You don't have to get tested. You don't have to consent to any tracking. They've had businesses and restaurants open indoors far longer. They always seem to time it perfectly to coincide with whenever New York begins a lockdown or is about to end a lockdown. So they do do their, and that's part of the laboratories of democracy. So I guess it's somewhat of a good thing, but it's just kind of ridiculous and hypocritical that they only get upset when, say, a Republican group takes advantage of their laxer laws.
But that's exactly the point.
Yes.
Is if you actually demonstrate in some visible way the extent of the hypocrisy and the fact that, not only that, there's really nothing that gets social media and the so-called mainstream press, which is basically just social media with brand names behind it, right, more angry than young, good-looking, and I refer to the young and the good-looking together, because having fun together. And as one of the, people who was observing young, good-looking people having fun together, it was inevitable that would stoke their anger. So
right, because we're dealing with miserable people. We're dealing with miserable people who are, basically confining themselves to their own homes for no reason and are basically taking out their own insecurities and their own personal issues in a political spectrum and trying to politicize their own social anxieties and their own depression as some kind of righteous cause. How dare these people have more fun than me? How dare they go do things and live their lives and be young and good looking? I mean, your words, not mine. But, that seems to be what a lot of our politics has boiled down to lately. It's basically just petty grievances, jealousies that they're trying to mask under some political ideology to make it seem a little more respectable.
Resentment. It's just it's about resentment. Resentment for people who were born looking a certain way or not looking a certain way or having certain sexual organs or having parents who raised them properly, regardless of their ethnic or economic backgrounds. Someone has to pay for that. So it's going to be whoever the New York Times, which has been taken over entirely by that sort of mentality, ironically, considering who owns the New York Times, a hereditary group of our crowd, assimilated, people with Jewish last names, who stand for the epitome of everything. But there's no paradox there. That, in fact, is to a large extent what it is that's playing out. It's those sort of people who feel guilty about their wealth and guilty about their privilege and who have no intention whatsoever of giving anything up.
I love that you repudiated your own point before you finished it. You started to say, oh, this is so ironic. How could these people, these old moneyed, established people believe this? And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, Coleman triggers in. It's like, no. That actually makes perfect sense because they're guilty. They have a guilty conscience and they're trying to virtue signal and self project, which is really what, again, it's all mass psychology. A lot of what this comes down to, sadly.
It's sad because it is a replacement of analysis and adult like decision making with emotion and particular resentment, rage, jealousy, and as Mrs. Coleman, who I can assure you is extremely female, has pointed out to me many times, it's basically the replace. And this is a Gavin McGinnis kind of, and actually. No, it's actually Mike Cernovich who first put this idea into my head. It's the feminization of a society. We need men and we need women. But when everyone starts thinking and acting like women and, lashing out and this whole thing with going back into people's social media history and finding things that they once said, it's like, this is probably before your times. Maybe you saw it in reruns. There used to be a show on TV back when I watched TV called Cheers. It was about a bunch of guys.
Love Cheers. I love night. Cheers. I watched it on TV Land.
Okay, good. So one of the things I noticed about Cheers was that these people were really terrible to each other. They were not particularly reliable friends. But at the end of every episode, it was all okay. And you know why? Because they were mostly guys. Let's put Diane aside. They were mostly a bunch of guys, and guys will do that to guys and then move on.
Right.
But this simmering, this idea of this resentment, and I'm going to get you, and I'm never going to let go of what you did to me, and I'm going to show you, and I'm going to get you, and I'm going to cancel you. it's girlishness. It's not even, you know what? I'll give the benefit of the doubt to the female of the species. It's not even a female thing. It's a high school girl's thing.
Right. I like how you had to caveat it a bit just to prevent yourself from getting in too much trouble. I'll also argue it's not just women; it's also Sicilians. They hold a grudge. They hold a vendetta.
I'm told. My middle name is not Mario, so I don't know.
Fair. And I also loved how you brought up the other Gavin McGinnis, who seems to have been depersoned or unpersoned and is no longer accepted in polite society, which is basically what happens to anyone on the right when they start to really cause a ruckus and start to strike a nerve. They just do what Stalin did, and you're basically erased and you're deplatformed. And it's like you were never there and you were never a person, and you have no views that are worth entertaining. And even if you're a little controversial, a little edgy, it doesn't matter. They will stomp you down for being milquetoast. Even there are people that have been canceled for anything. I mean, there's nothing that they won't silence you for, which is really sad, and it's disgusting, and it's what's happened in our politics, that you can't just have differences of opinion. I know you've been doing these interesting philosophical talks from your car, I'm assuming somewhere in North Jersey, and you talked about it. You said that you yourself, I believe, have lost maybe some job opportunities or jobs because of your politics. Do you want to talk about that at all? I mean, because I'm sure a lot of people can relate.
I'm very comfortable talking about that. I mean, on the drive from my home in Passaic County into Montclair, New Jersey, I've been doing these two minutes, because that's how long of a video you can upload to Twitter. 2 minutes, just kind of extemporaneous thoughts about stuff, you know, like everybody does on the internet.
Right.
And I did mention in passing that I have lost literally, you know, either become a partner who has become so uncomfortable with his partners that I had to move on, or in the case of the last firm I was at, actually removed from the partnership on very short notice and on very unhappy terms, because I was doing a non-woke litigation on behalf of non-woke causes or clients. And it used to be that lawyers were understood to be prepared to represent any number of sides on issues, and they weren't necessarily considered to be adopting the position of the people that they represented. Not that I necessarily have a problem with the positions of the people that I represented, but I had to leave the law firm of Archer and Griner, basically because of my representation of Gab. I then ultimately felt I had to leave where did I go from there? I was representing Gavin McGinnis and was made to feel very uncomfortable at Mandelbaum Salzburg, where I just was. But when I filed the lawsuit on behalf of Women for Trump, who, with respect to the Black Lives Matter murals in New York, they over the weekend, you know, met and said, "Ron's got to go," and I was out the door like nothing. Right. The reason I'm with Harmeet Dhillon now is because Harmeet is the antithesis of that kind of lawyer and that kind of law firm.
That woke big law.
Well, you know, I haven't been in a true big law firm since well before you were born.
Fantastic.
It was,
as everyone knows, which was in 2006, if anyone's wondering.
I didn't last very long in the multi-hundred law firm. You know, I have been in a couple of, you know, three-figure size firms, and I do always ultimately end up stepping on some toes. Thank God I've always been able to keep busy and always been able to keep employed, because I'm decently good at what I do with the talent that God has given me, and my wife kicking me in the butt to get me out of bed in the morning. It does get done.
Well, that's the spirit. That's the real American spirit to, you know, overcome these obstacles there.
American ADD spirit.
Yes, but it's sad. It's sad that, you know, you can't, in your case, represent quote unquote controversial clients. I don't think these are controversial clients, but you can't represent people that don't adhere to the political establishment's viewpoints. And, you know, then they'll cancel you. They'll try to, you know, they say, oh, you have freedom of speech, but they'll take away your ability to earn a living. They'll take away your ability to have a job, to have a profession, have a career. And it's happening to many people who, you know, sometimes in some cases, in some industries, they can't bounce back as well as others have. And they've just been completely ruined by it. And it's absolutely disgusting. And it's not what happens in a free society. And it shouldn't happen in a free society. And this is much more, and this is much deeper than just being banned on social media. Like if you can't support yourself because you've been canceled because of your views, that's about as fascist as it comes in terms of, you know, punishing people for their politics. I mean, they're making you destitute. They're making people destitute.
Right. And thank God I'm not being made destitute. But you know, did I take a hit? I took a hit. The fact is, it's a real business dilemma for these law firm leaders. I mean, for example, at Archer & Griner, which is a fairly large New Jersey firm, in South Jersey, and I was one of the partners in the North Jersey office. They were afraid that my representation of Gab would cause people to say that we're representing Nazis, and that they would then have problems with their vendors and their clients and their recruiting, and whether or not it's asking a lot for an institutional law firm, where people have longstanding relationships and people have been partners for, you know, sometimes 20, 25 years, to, for the sake of Ron Coleman's high principles, put all that on the line. And especially a firm like Archer, which is very interested in becoming sort of a player in Philadelphia politics. They've got a very active and successful Philadelphia office. So, you know, they threw me under the bus on Gab. And when I moved to Mandelbaum, Salzburg, and I said, that won't happen here, right? And they said, of course, that won't happen here, which was really their way of saying, well, we really need an IP partner. When they realized that it could happen to them also, because a secretary complained that I was representing Gavin McInnes. And I tried to say, don't you understand, the reason I'm representing Gavin McInnes is not because he's a Nazi. It's because he wrongly accused Nazi. And that's the mission that we're trying to achieve for our client. Well, that's all very interesting, but we can't have that kind of controversy, because what are our Jewish clients going to think? Well, what are our Jewish clients going to think? Why don't you tell them to give Coleman a call? Okay.
But that's a great point. The death of nuance. There is no nuance anymore, that you could be accused of something and it doesn't necessarily mean it's true. And then you defending them from those accusations doesn't mean that you're defending the validity of the accusation. You're actually challenging the validity of the accusation, but that just apparently goes over the head of, I guess, secretaries and law offices, because they apparently think that the religious Jew is actually an SS member or something.
Sorry, secretaries and managing partners and management committees. And look, these are the people whose money is on the line. And at the end of the day,
they have no time for the philosophy and the debates, and I actually kind of sympathize with them, because they're not even the real issue. It's really the people that will go after them. It's the mob. It's the mob that's been enabled by big tech, by academia, by all the institutions that
remember will, what happened. They were starting to make lists of people at Jones Day, who were working for the president, and you know, my partner Harmeet Dhillon was. She had smoke coming out of her ears when she would talk about this, about the fact that the Jones Day people folded in response to this after many years of doing very, very well as being Donald Trump's campaign's lawyers. But all of a sudden, when the going got tough, the tough ran for the exit, with, you know, having already collected millions of dollars in fees. You know, that's
the grift.
You know, that's the thing, Gavin. If you want to say that we are going to prophylactically protect our practice from troublemakers like Ron Coleman, and we're going to just be kind of get along to go along guys, and basically going to be like most people in the world who are risk averse and who have wealth and want to maintain it and grow it, then I can't really blame you for that. And my mistake for thinking that you were something other than that, because that you can buy and sell me. And that isn't that really what it's all about. It's all about the guilt, right? But when you already represent, your duty is to down with the ship of reputation. You don't throw that client overboard in order to save your own skin. And that's what a lot of Donald Trump's lawyers did. And I remember seeing all these people who, you know, who were tweeting. And as you know, I spent some time on Twitter.
You know, yes, very true.
Tweeting, you know, these aren't election lawyers handling these cases. Well, yeah, the election lawyers ran for the hills.
Right.
The election lawyers, you know, ran off scared. And I was, you know, it was shameful.
Well, what is there from a policy standpoint that could help fight back against this cancel culture? Is it as when Trump said in 15 and 16, open up the libel laws, open up the defamation laws? Are there other policies? I mean, what would you suggest, if anything? Or is this just a consequence of the times we're living in and we have to accept it and just keep fighting along?
Well, I think the oft-repeated axiom that, you know, it's the culture, stupid, is really the problem here. I've done plaintiffs. Let's put it this way. The work that I've done in defamation as a plaintiff's lawyer, and for years and years, I only represented defendants in defamation cases. The problems in defamation cases are not coming from Times versus Sullivan. It's almost never that. It's almost always another problem with the case. For example, in Gavin McInnes's case, we've got a judge who has sat on a motion to dismiss by the defendant coming on 2 years soon. And that's a real problem. They don't teach you in law school how to deal with that. And there's not anything you can do about it either. But on a more general basis, I don't think it's a defamation issue. And I also don't think it's a regulatory issue. And I do think there's a lot that we can do to improve, and it ought to do to improve. I do think that, you know, you've read some of my things. There is a genuine consumer protection issue with respect to deplatforming, especially established accounts. It is a deceptive practice to induce someone to build a following and to get people to come to a social media platform and use it and join it and be on it because Laura Loomer's on there or Gavin McInnes is on there or Milo is on there. And when the heat comes on, you just drop them and they have no recourse. That's BS. That's a deceptive practice. No one has pressed that point yet, because if regulators don't do it, judges are not going to buy in. And regulators haven't done it, not at the state level, not at the national level. And I've had these conversations. Nobody wants to pull the trigger. That's something we can do, but that's a symptom, not a cause. The cause is cultural. And I don't have, you know, I think everyone should go back to God, and everyone should, you know, should be more, you know, more serious and more virtuous, just as Ron Coleman is. But I would even settle for Gavin Wax. Okay. But
yes.
And that's, you know, that it's a lot to ask a society to all of a sudden get religion.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's just like putting on weight. It's a lot easier to put on weight than it is to get rid of it. It's a lot easier to lose your faith than regain it, so to speak, if I can, you know, use that sort of that weight analogy. But you make a great point. There are areas
as a society. The vast majority of people who are not religious have never been exposed to bona fide religious instruction.
No, they've seen straw mans that they've been told, and they've been told to vilify anyone who's religious as, or just view people that are religious as stupid and backwards or as hateful, especially in the case of Christians. That's, for example, I mean that's what's being pumped through the culture and into the minds of susceptible young people who are buying it at large, and that's kind of where we are. I mean, we could talk about that for hours, but you made some good points that there are areas of the law and of policy that just simply have not caught up to what these platforms are from a technological standpoint, and then the regulators and the courts just don't understand how to really treat them or view them. I mean, you just mentioned, you know, organically building a platform. Talk about all the people that, you know, spend actual money on advertising on these platforms just to have them pull the rug under it. Or even worse, they get the algorithms to shadow ban them, which is totally happening, and they're still on the platform, quote unquote, but their reach is nothing. And they've spent money to get the reach, and they spend money to build that audience. I mean, there's massive issues there.
I had a judge in the Southern District of Florida rule in the Laura Loomer case that there could be no tortious interference with her business relationship with Twitter because there was no business relationship. She had no commercial expectancy. This is someone who was raising hundreds of thousands a year and living on it. That was her living,
right,
from her Twitter account. And the judge said, "Oh, there's no contract there. We need there's no contract. The only reason that I'm not able to sue Twitter in Florida that I have to go to California is because there's a contract with a forum selection clause." Said, well, yeah, that's a kind of a contract, yeah, but it's not really a business relationship. This is a federal judge, okay. Mm-hmm. So when you get this kind of reasoning, and this is now before the 11th Circuit, you know, it's not surprising that this is the kind of
– this is happening.
You can get, right.
So it comes down to a lot of times to the judges. Like you said earlier, it's the judge sitting on the motion. It's not really so much the law or you know, the interpretations of the law. It's just these judges. But I also want to bring it back to another one of your philosophical two-minute car talks in North Jersey where you basically pose the question, does the left understand how – evil they are acting, or they truly believe that they're righteous? And then we're bringing it back to this cancel culture that they're canceling people. We just saw this case with that cheerleader, I believe in Virginia, who she just got accepted to this college. And, you know, this kid saved the Snapchat video of her singing along to a rap song, used the N-word, and saved it for 4 years to get her kicked out of college. People like that, people, I forgot his name, but people like that guy genuinely believe that they are the righteous ones, that they're doing good work, that they're stopping some bad person from advancing in society. They don't clearly see what's really happening, that they are the bad guy, or do they actually know and they're just really nefarious? I mean, maybe you can't really view it at the individual level, but you know, as a movement as a whole, how do you take it? Because you posed the question, you didn't answer it.
Well, I think the best way to think of it is instead of asking ourselves this question with respect to people we've never met, like this guy, this young man, ask yourself about the people you know in your life who are. I wrote a little while ago about a lunch that I had with a very well educated and articulate and insightful friend of mine in the neighborhood, and among his observations was, and this was not included in the thread that I tweeted about our discussion, was that he asked some of his Biden supporting neighbors, okay, listen, you and I both know what happened in this election, and I understand in a way this idea that anything is justified in order to keep Donald Trump out of the White House because he's just the worst man who ever lived. I get that that's your view, but why do you want your children to grow up in a world where an election can be fraudulently manipulated this way? Why doesn't that bother you? And they simply couldn't hear the question. I don't know what to tell you, but that's where we are. That is where we are. They cannot hear the question.
So I guess that answers it then. I mean, it's sad that we're at that point in our political discourse, but you know, that's the kind of stuff that leads to irreparable divisions in a society that can never be truly healed. I mean, we've kind of, you know, everyone's talking about crossing the Rubicon. We've crossed the Rubicon in terms of our country's unity. I mean, maybe you're more of an optimist than I am, but I really think that the divisions are so deep-seated that people literally are getting to the point where they're dehumanizing the other side. And if you look at, sure, you know, look at the historical record, anytime that has ever happened, it's never ended up well. It's hardly ever been reversed when one side is just blatantly dehumanizing the other, and anything they do is justified because they really think they're fighting against, you know, subhuman forces. I mean, that's not a healthy way. That's not a healthy way to run society.
No, there's no way to be optimistic about that. The only question is, can you ride it out long enough for demographic change and cultural forces that are not, you know, we do tend to overestimate the importance of the news media and social media in terms of what's really happening in life. That is less of a compelling point, though, than it was before the lockdown era. And the willingness of people to accede to the complete removal of their freedom of movement and personal choice about what risks they will and will not take regarding their health, and the unwillingness of the non-executive branches of government to permit this to go on, the judiciary and the legislative branches, has been a demonstration of the complete breakdown, not only of the culture, but of the political institutions that we've relied on for so long. So,
well, has our Constitution not failed us? I mean, yes, there was a win today in courts. There was a win today in the courts for religious freedom against King Nipple Rings Cuomo in New York. But I mean, I love the Constitution. I think it's a brilliant document. I don't view it religiously. I think there is this tendency on the right, particularly among conservatives, this sort of civic religion where they view, or they used to view at least, I think this has been changing rapidly, these institutions and these documents as infallible and they're perfect and they created this system and everything is aligned and it'll never be broken. But the only reason we're in the position we're in today, especially post-COVID or the midst of COVID rather, is because these documents and these institutions and the judiciary and the legislative branches have all failed at the federal, state, and local levels. I mean, there's no way to say that our Bill of Rights have not been completely trampled on. I mean, you know, the arguments that maybe civil libertarians were making 20 years ago, you know, are one thing, you know, and people may have been able to, you know, do after 9/11, I'm speaking of, you know, maybe under the guise of security, et cetera. But now, I mean, it's like they've taken those same concerns. Now it's on steroids based on what's going on with the lockdowns, with shutting down churches, with shutting down synagogues, businesses, confined to your home, stay at home orders. I mean, where do we go from here?
I don't know. I mean, there's no question that my responses in terms of, you know, my ability to do things besides having conversations with, you know, bright young people like you on Twitter and on podcasts is fighting these sort of tactical battles, which are unlikely to actually result in major change. They have to be fought. I think we cannot give up on them. I think it has been shameful how the Supreme Court and the lower courts have abdicated their responsibility to stand up for liberty. I'm not that old that I can say, listen, it's almost over for me. It's not. I'm not that old. I am the oldest young Republican.
You just got an award from a young Republican club, I was going to say.
That's right. It doesn't make me very old. But I have children and grandchildren, and I want them to grow up in a world, and what happens in America affects the whole world. There's really nowhere to run either. There's nowhere to run. So we got to fight these tactical fights. Is there a bigger picture fight for us to fight? I mean, as an observant Jew, I believe that by observing our religion and having a relationship with God, I'm making some contribution to that. But that's a sort of a, you know,
personal.
It's not personal. It's quite global, but I don't know how it works.
Okay.
I got no idea how it works. So the question is, what do I do in my personal battle? I fight these battles and I meet up with guys like you and I, you know, try, you know, I just think, you know, I will say that the margins on a lot of these issues, and even though the culture is so rotten to such a great extent, you still have a lot of important decisions that have to be made that are still at the margins, and where the difference between five justices and six justices and four justices in the Supreme Court not only has makes a difference in a given decision, but down the way, you know, it's a whole domino effect. These things do matter. Great. But as my, you know,
That's why you can't give up the political process, because, you know, you may not get everything all at once, but it is about these marginal victories that do make a tangible difference in your life. I mean, we could talk about, you know, the conservative judicial strategy with judges, et cetera. In some cases, they may have failed, but we have concrete examples of this working on our favor with the SCOTUS decision on religious freedom of religion in New York and places like that. That has a real life, real world consequence that's positive, that was beneficial to people who like freedom. So we can't just abandon the process.
We can't. They're battles, but I'm not the prophet. I'm not the big enough picture guy that I can answer the question of how do we make, you know, at the end of the day, if the moral fiber isn't there, if people are not educated, if institutions of higher learning are going to become self parodies, you know, with no real connection to the what was once universally accepted as the standards of intellectual rigor and inquiry, and journalism is merely just an Pravda-like entertainment or virtue signaling exercise. We just, you know, I hope maybe the best case scenario is that we have a dual society, and that somewhere, somehow, those of us who are not part of the, you know, the woke society will be allowed to eke out.
They'll never let it. They hate the idea of a peaceful separation.
Bake the cake.
Yes, exactly. They will never just let people have freedom of association and, say, freedom of separation, however you want to describe it, because the second you're able to form your own societies or your own, say, the laboratories of democracies with the state, see what's happening in Florida. It doesn't matter that the policies in Florida have been proven to be better than those of New York. They will still demonize what's going on in Florida because they don't want any examples of a society or some kind of jurisdiction being successful embracing a different viewpoint than their orthodoxy, because then it repudiates them. So they'll never allow, that maybe goes back to your original question, because maybe deep down they know their views lead them down this path and ultimately are destructive and are not productive. That's why they don't want anyone else to form a competing society or competing, you know, jurisdictions to prove them wrong.
I think you're right. And that's why, I guess, at the end of the day, it's going to get jiggy.
Yes, it is. It is. But you're still an optimistic guy. You're not one of the doomers and gloomers on Twitter. You've been pretty consistent in terms of, you know, you've never been the crazy optimists who think, you know, Trump is going to ride in on a white horse and just burn Congress to the ground. But you're also not, you know, saying, oh, the end is near and give up on everything. You seem to have this sort of balanced but generally optimistic viewpoint of the future. I mean, what do you think about what's going on? I mean, I know you don't want to touch on this too much, but I have to ask you. I mean, there does seem to be segments on Twitter that basically believe that there's some plan in the works and that everything is going to work out. And there's trust the plan, trust everything that's going on. Don't be worried. We're going to turn this around. Everything's right around the corner. It's kind of like this, like kind of like a religious cult sort of thing, the way they preach it. And then there's the other side that just give up on everything. I mean, how do you view this? And of course, there's a lot of grifting going on in between.
First of all, I think the word grifting is used entirely too much. Grifting doesn't mean conning people into thinking that you are right and you're a smart guy and you should follow them on Twitter.
Correct.
Grifting is give me money,
correct,
to do something that I'm not going to do. It's a con. It's a different kind of. And I haven't really seen, frankly, nearly as much of that as people use the word. I think the word is being ridiculously overused. I have, at the end of the day, I think that you either have to conclude that Trump is not nearly as smart as you thought he was and not as brave as you thought he was, in which case he's been rolled, as Mike Cernovich puts it, and he's just a sucker and it's over, and he's doing what by all lights it looks like he's doing, which is not getting anything done in terms of an obviously fraudulent election, in which case we're probably not necessarily so much worse off without him, because he's not enough. In office, he would not be enough to get the job done. And let's at least have Biden, because we know what opposition looks like. And in many respects, you can be stronger in opposition because negative energy has a tactical power that positive energy doesn't have. Now, I don't want to be sanguine about that. I think that if indeed it goes the wrong way, we're going to be in a world of trouble in a lot of ways. But it's going to be super duper interesting. For example, Biden as president would not be able to simply go back into the Iran deal and change relations with Israel back to what they were during the Obama years. It's not going to happen. You know why? Because, as someone pointed out to me today, the Arab states won't let him. They don't like Biden. They don't like Iran. They're pretty cool with Israel. They don't like the Palestinians. A lot of Trump has changed the truth on the ground in many, many important respects. He's also uncoupled the buy-in that all but the most brain-damaged Republicans have had to the institutions, the political institutions and the state institutions. People are going to be a lot more willing to be a lot more outspoken about their resistance to oppressive government. So that's one thing. Another thing is, alternatively, if indeed Trump is all that, he may still be on to something. There may still be another unplayed card. I've made it very clear many times I don't know what that card is. It doesn't look like it's a judicial one. I don't understand some of the things that have happened in the Supreme Court and some of the things that have not happened, but I also don't understand some of the dogs that haven't barked. Some of the biggest loudmouths in the Democratic Party have been very curiously quiet. You think that they would be taking this opportunity to make mad, incredible hay out of Trump's obvious humiliating loss about the potential of losing the Senate. Where is it? Where's Schiff? Where's Pelosi? Where's Schumer? Where are these guys? I don't know. I don't know what that means. I just know a lot of things don't make sense. And we're in a situation historically where unprecedented things are happening all the time. So anything could be happening now. Do I think military operations are taking place underground? No, I don't think so. You know, do I think, you know, so no. I don't think any of that good stuff is happening. But are there things we don't understand? Are there things we'll never know? Yes. Are they going to matter? Do I understand the Barr arc of his career? The timing of his departure? Do I get it? No. Does it fit with the idea that he was just a swamp creature? No. Why wouldn't he ride out the rest of his term through January? That doesn't make any sense. What's going on? I just don't know.
And we're living in crazy times. Those were all great, great points and observations. I agree with most of it. And, you know, we don't know what's going on, and everything next week could, you know, change everything for us. We never know. It's a day by day thing. These 2 months are going to feel like 2 years. It already feels like way longer than it's been. Just everything is just moving slow. The news cycle is moving slow. Everything's dragging. And before we even got on the podcast, we both agreed we didn't want to touch the election of the presidency, because all we do is talk about it. And it's just been, you know, a circular discussion where we're not really hammering home anything concrete. That was all fantastic. And I think we're running up now on the hour, so I don't want to keep you for too long, but this was a fantastic discussion. I really appreciate you talking through the internet connections earlier as you closed out your 100 tabs in your browser. But can you please let my viewers, who I'm assuming mostly are already your followers, how they can follow you more and where they can go to get more insights and wisdom from the great Ron Coleman of North Jersey?
Well, listen, just like my Twitter handle is spelled just like my name. I should have used it as you did on my label here. But
next,
if you look for Ron Coleman on Twitter or on the internet, you're going to find me. You're going to find me at my Twitter page, and that's really where I hang out all the time these days when I'm not spreading COVID among, you know, among young Republicans in Jersey City. And I'd love to have more people join the fun, especially the timing of this podcast, by the way, is fantastic for us, because there's a bloodbath going on in MAGA Twitter tonight among a number of axes that I just, as I mentioned at the beginning, I don't understand. I don't know.
Wait, you did mention that. Can you dive into that a bit more, into more detail? Because I'm not even sure I'm aware of what's going on. Well, I've been just reporting for the last
time. My longtime friend, Econ Chick, is savaging Tracy Beans. I mean, what is it? I don't get it.
What's the point of controversy between the two?
I'm going to let people look in themselves, and I don't, because I've been able to avoid a lot of this. Last week, a couple of other my friends were going at it. Harold Wren and Shipwreck Crew. There are a lot of people who I'm friendly with, and that people are accusing each other of being grifters and being suckers. And it's almost as if someone were trying to sow discord and dissent. But the reason that I don't think that's the case, Gavin, is because we don't really matter.
that's a both depressing and realistic endpoint.
It's not going to have any effect on things. I mean, it's a fun place for us to hang out, and it helps some of us get a little bit of a little bit of business and some opportunities and to make some great friends. But what we discuss on Twitter, I think, is extremely marginal significance in terms of what's going to happen on January 6th, when I assume you're going to be in Washington.
I will try to be there to the best of my ability. Will you be there on January 6th? That's the real question.
No, I will not. I will not. Unless they ask me, unless they ask me to speak, and I don't even know who they would be. No, I don't do mass things. I'm an avid indoorsman.
Oh, wow, great! I love it. That should be on your Twitter bio. Avid indoorsman. Fantastic hair as well. You should definitely keep running with that and using my photo whenever you need to sell that point home. But everyone, I want to. I'll remind everyone to follow the great Ron Coleman at Ron Coleman. Follow the Waxcast at the Waxcast Podcast, www.waxcastpodcast.com. Available on iTunes, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, you name it. And we will definitely be having Ron on again next time, probably to be talking about, Judaica and Hebrew studies. I think that'll be an interesting topic.
And life in the Gulag.
Yes, and or life in the Gulag, depending on where things end up later this month or next month, rather. But anyway, guys, stay tuned for more. Thank you for tuning into the Waxcast. More to come.
Great talking to you. Good night.